This episode of The Drunken Odyssey is brought to you by Scribophile, an online community with thousands of serious writers working in every conceivable genre. If you're eager to improve your own work and network with others, Scribophile is for you. Scribophile has educational tutorials, exciting forums, and most importantly, the ability to exchange in-depth critiques with other writers, using a karma system that keeps the exchange fair and equal. What is most exciting to me is that Scribophile allows writers to critique novel chapters, which is not something a writer can be guaranteed to experience in an MFA program. A basic account is free and grants you all the features, but upgrading to a premium account allows you to gain access to posting numerous works at once, requires no additional karma points to enter contests and other special features for only $9 a month or $65 a year. That's a lot less than a Netflix subscription. Listeners of The Drunken Odyssey will receive a 20% discount on top of those already low rates. Check out this week's show notes for details.
Anais Casey was born Anais Hamilton in 1918 and raised unglamorously in a lower middle-class suburb of New York. Her father was a translator and traveled often. Her mother was an alcoholic of the housewife variety, and so Anais was raised primarily by an older sister, Victoria, with whom she mostly quarreled. Esther pictures Anais as very narrow, thinks of her as someone who fails to take up space. She feels a little guilty for this imagining, does not want to understand Anais as young and thin and pale and pretty, but she pictures her with too much tenderness to do otherwise. Tenderness and beauty are inextricable for Esther, though she wishes that they weren't and that her understanding of beauty was different.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 529. On today's show, I speak with fiction writer Catherine Harlan about her debut collection of stories, Fruiting Bodies. So here's the part of the show where I discuss books news or literary news or make an accounting of what writing I've gotten done, or maybe just complain about the ailments of a middle-aged body. But I don't have anything like that this week. Alexander Pate was an intern for the show for a longish time while he moved to England to teach and earn a degree and get engaged to a woman and move back to the States and break off his engagement and teach. He had a hearty sense of humor and a memorable sense of how to live in this world ethically. I was informed last weekend that he died in an auto accident in North Carolina. I've been doing this podcast for 10 years, about one-fifth of my life. Some of my interview subjects are no longer with us, and sometimes I feel that loss physically. I become less when I see them go. Charlie Bethel performed The Odyssey as an emotional one-person show, and one day that dynamic performer was simply gone. My friend, the Shakespearean actor, director, and scholar, Kevin Crawford, died. I'm sure there are others. I really don't want to go through the list. The loss of Alex is bad. He was just starting out on his own writing odyssey. Back in March, he came to Orlando, and we grabbed lunch at a bar called Miller's Ale House. This may have been the first time we met in person. I think it was. I remember there was an infernal conversation about which beer to order. Negotiations went on forever. The sense that I got from talking to him through lunch was that a lot of his angst seemed to be behind him. He was funny and tough and sensitive and smart. I hugged him and we said goodbye, and I remember thinking, is a hug necessary here? I think if you're asking the question, then the answer is probably yes. This doesn't count if you have a restraining order out on you, so don't get lawyers involved if you get yourself arrested, but apart from that, a hug is usually the right thing. Hug your people if they're willing to be hugged, is my message. I'll be reading at Loose Lips on July 5th at Little Indies, so I should probably write something for that. Those of you who live near or in the City Beautiful can attend. Unless things go awry, I will release the audio as an episode. All right, let's talk to Catherine.
And now, the interview of the day.
Catherine Harlan received an MFA from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she now teaches writing. She was the recipient of the 2019 August Derleth Graduate Creative Writing Prize. Her work has appeared in Gettysburg Review, Strange Horizons, and elsewhere. Her debut work of fiction, Fruiting Bodies, Stories, has just been released by Norton. Catherine, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So how did you get caught up in this writing business? Why did you ruin your life in that way?
Personally, I think I'm one of those people who never really had a choice. I was interested in being an author. I mean, I was writing regularly around fourth grade. I had a teacher who gave us an hour a day to write stories, and I started a little book of ghost stories, and I've been doomed ever since.
Ghost stories?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, horror was actually the first genre that I found really compelling. I don't exactly know why, but I think there are a lot of genre elements that show up in the book that show that that's kind of stuck with me.
Well, I actually had a similar experience. I was in middle school, not elementary school, but yeah, like life was a horror story. You went to school every day, just surrounded by nothing but psychological warfare for no good reason at all. All kinds of horrible things are happening to your body. So curiously, though, that happened earlier for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, being a tween to early teenager, like you said, it is kind of a horror story. In addition to the obvious body horror, you know, you're, I think, coming into an awareness of your own mortality and the immortality of everybody around you, which was probably part of why ghost stories were so interesting to me.
And I think, you know, part of the appeal of horror, and maybe it is part of this adolescent thing, but you're like, what in the world does the world mean? Like, everything seems so nonsensical. And the even scarier possibility is, no, maybe this is what meaning looks like, in which case there's no hope for me figuring anything out. And so letting some ghosts into a story maybe actually helps process what the world is like.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think horror is one of those places we go to make sense of kind of extremes. And the, like, I've always trended towards supernatural horror. I find the real actions of humans awful enough without having to come up with more. And so I think kind of giving a sort of magical embodiment to those very terrifying existential concepts, it helps to cope with them and come to terms with them a bit.
And I'm guessing that hasn't entirely went away. It seems like some of your fiction is very grounded in reality, even when there's great ambiguity to not necessarily what has happened, but what the meaning is of what's happened. And then you are, you know, a magical realist or surrealist, depending on how weird things get. Yeah, I think that's healthy, that kind of surprising mixture. So I presume it's a case where you write a story, you don't have it all figured out, and then if it goes kind of sideways, that's acceptable.
Sort of. I usually have the rough premise of a story when I start writing. I honestly, usually the first thing I have figured out about a story is the ending. So typically I have a pretty good idea of, you know, whether I'm going to be writing something that's sort of speculative or has genre elements or is sort of in that more grounded, realistic realm. I don't think I've had any sort of suddenly change genres midway through, though. I'm sure it'll happen eventually.
Okay, so I'm wrong about that. I do think it is probably quite helpful when you're writing work that might be experimental. Yeah, if you have an ending in mind, because one of the things that's clear to me is no matter how strange a story might be, you want the reader to have a great experience reading the story. And I think I told John Waters, like, anarchy without craft is just, it's boring. So anarchy needs structure or care or the eye of an artist to be interesting. Not that your stories are necessarily anarchic, but the sort of laws of physics or the rules of the world might be a little anarchic, or at least not identical to what's going to happen when I go outside my front door.
Right, right. Yeah, I think at least for me, where I draw on those genre elements most is I've always found that sort of a fabulist or surrealist writing, I found those elements most interesting when they're sort of being used to communicate an emotional reality. I mean, there are also, I think there are stories in the collection that could just be called outright fantasy. I mean, I really enjoy fantasy and horror science fiction. And so there are a couple stories like Fiddler Fool Pair, I'd say, is rooted pretty firmly in fantasy. But the more sort of surrealist or grounded ones, I am interested in those genre elements as sort of ways to put characters into situations that might be more acute than the situations we would probably face those similar feelings in the real world, or that sort of literalize an emotional experience the characters are having. You know, I think that when you're mixing genre, it has to be to a purpose. And for me, that purpose is usually to get at something about character or characters' experiences.
Well, I think of Hunting the Viper King, about this poor girl and her, it seems like, delusional father. I kept waiting for his delusions to crash in upon his consciousness. And it turns out, no, that's not that kind of story. And yeah, the Viper King, this legendary snake, turns out to actually be real.
So
shame on me.
Well, you know, that one I was hoping it would be a surprise. So I did it. It sounds like it worked there in that case.
Well, it's a surprise, but then it's also another surprise. So the premise of the story is this dad who's raising a daughter on his own out of a camper, which is already kind of, yeah, it's taking the isolation of homeschooling and then compounding that, and then also just removing all structure daily life in pursuit of absolute knowledge that could be found if one slays and cooks the Viper King, this giant legendary snake that for some reason is roaming around the United States.
Right.
And so, yeah, since the first short story in the collection is about two children who are probably quite doomed, I kind of expected, okay, so there's more doom. And yeah, no, it wasn't about that. And so, yeah, that was a lovely change, is when it's like, oh, okay, no, the snake is real, which is just, I don't know, if you have a choice between having a giant legendary snake be real or not exist in a story, like, okay, it existing is always more interesting.
Right, right. Yeah. And that, I mean, that was part of the biggest reason for that plot decision. I think that actually, that was one story where when I started writing, I did intend the snake to be real, but I went back and forth on it as I wrote, sort of. And the thing that finally cemented me in it being real at the end of the story was actually kind of dooming in its own way, in that I was thinking of it as a story sort of about growing up in a situation where your parent has something. You know, you compared it to homeschooling, and I think that's sort of a fair comparison, especially homeschooling that's sort of inspired by either like a really intense personal goal a parent might have, or maybe a really intense sort of ideological position. And I think if you're a child, especially a young teenager who's had your life restricted in a certain way by your parent striving for something like that, sort of the best and worst possibility at once is that, like, the thing that they're striving for is actually real, achievable, important, because that at the same time sort of legitimizes the way that your life has been almost sacrificed to this goal. But it also, if it wasn't real, then that would have been for nothing. It sort of feels like it's something that both traps you more and gives reason to these decisions your parents made, in a way I think makes the story a lot more complicated and interesting than if it had just been a delusion.
And then the ending also has a really great surprise that I won't reveal, but
that's the other thing I am proud of about this story, that the magical snake being real isn't the twist.
It's not the climactic twist.
No.
So can you talk a little bit about the pleasure of writing short stories? So I kind of write whatever it is I think I'm able to write at any particular moment. Often that's me not writing anything. you know, these are all solid short stories of very solid length. And so the marketplace is always drilling into everyone's ears, like novel, it's got to be the novel, you got to write a novel. And, you know, this is a great story collection. Can you talk a little bit about just why short stories are so important a medium? Because the things that you're discussing in these stories, I'm not sure they're novels, like these are great stories.
Thank you. And yeah, I don't think any of these stories could be novels. And they're very long stories. So there were certainly moments when the first drafts of a couple of these hit around 20,000 words. And I was kind of wondering if it might just be easier for them to be novels. But I think a short story can get at things a novel can't, in the same way that any genre kind of has a special ability to get a certain angle on an experience or an idea that you couldn't get in another form. And I think, at least for me, as a person who has written short stories and is now working on a novel and really feeling nostalgic for the short stories, I think what short stories are really good at is sort of capturing a moment in time and a very particular feeling. Like, you see characters, of course, go through changes and make important choices in short stories because that's a fundamental aspect of plot. But I think the emotional experience in short stories, it doesn't have to necessarily progress the way that the emotional experience in a novel does. It can be about like capturing very exactly the feeling of a specific time or place or sort of moment in life. And that's what I found myself trying to do and wanting to get at with a lot of these short stories, especially sort of the ones about coming of age or about like pivotal moments of change in a person's life. They didn't feel like they could or should be novels. They weren't about kind of series of events. It was more about how does it feel to be this age in this moment experiencing this thing. And I think short stories let you get at those moments of stillness or realization, I guess, in a way that I don't think novels are as equipped to. Like, they're better at getting at longer portions of your life or change over time. And so I think it's just kind of a difference of you use different tools to get at different ideas.
Yeah. So the kind of things that you love about short stories, like, might be the most minor moment in a novel.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily what the novel's about. It's more like an accent note, maybe.
Right, right. Like, you, something you might end a chapter on in a novel, and then you have to move on to something else. That can be an entire short story. And I think it's, I'm not sure if I'm making sense with this description, but the short stories that have felt really successful to me have felt like almost a kind of time capsule. Like, especially, again, those coming of age ones, I drew a lot on experiences of being those ages and feeling those things around those ages. And I think being able to capture like just that moment in time and spend a good 30 or 40 pages getting at a very specific emotion in a very specific moment with a level of detail and focus that I don't think you would put on that one moment within a novel. I think it would be something you sort of move past on the way to something else.
Well, I also note that you're great in treating ambiguity. And what I mean by that is the stories don't seem samey when it comes to the problem of ambiguity. But I think that you, at least with these stories, are responding to, well, I think of William James, who said, like, there's no knowing the mind of another person. Like, that's not a thing that happens. Mm-hmm. And if you believe that, then you can't really tell stories, or you just pretend like we can, even though you know that we can't. Of course, how extreme was he being? Mm-hmm. I don't know, but it does seem like even with people we're intimate with, that there's a lot that might be withheld. If we don't know ourselves completely, okay, well then, like, talking to other people, how the hell are we going to know exactly what someone else is thinking? And a short story just can't be like a diverted little memoir going me, 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 me. Mm-hmm. So I think that you have a very interesting way of dealing with ambiguity and figuring out, okay, what are the concrete things that I know I'm going to give the reader? Because it can't just be all ambiguity all the time, because that's frustrating.
Right.
That's like, all right, you just jangled your keys a whole lot. I didn't get like it didn't make a song. it seems to me like most novels are a lot more plotted, which means accepting that we can understand other people at face value a lot more. And, you know, I don't think they're character studies, because to say that seems to say, okay, and it's not plotted, right? It's just, right. Okay, here we're observing the ants in the ant farm. And it's like, no, it's not quite like that. Mm-hmm. But I do think that the ways that you treat ambiguity in all of these different stories is pretty fascinating. And it does seem to be like an abiding theme in your work that has a lot of variations.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think sort of ambiguity or knowledge and kind of the knowledge we can have access to, the knowledge we can't have access to, how we fill those gaps in between our experiences and what we can and can't know about other people's. That's a theme I'm really interested in my work in general, but definitely particularly in this collection. I think all of the stories touch on that to some degree or another, and a couple of them are even sort of explicitly about that. You know, what the story you had me read from, Take Only What Belongs to You, is very much about this character who has in her mind this relationship with an author whose work she's really loved and has to kind of come to the conclusion over the course of the story, or come to an understanding that the person who wrote those stories seems to be very different from the person she's been imagining who wrote them. And one of the things that I was interested in writing the collection, writing several of those stories, is I think that you mentioned how if we can't know what's going on in someone else's experience, that makes it hard for us to tell stories. And I think what's interesting is that we also tell stories to cope with that. When we don't know what someone else is feeling in our real lives, somebody who's close to us, we take what we know about them and what we've experienced about them, and we put together a sort of story about what we think they're probably experiencing, and then we act within that story. And so that way that we use narratives to fill the gaps around that ambiguity, and especially when those narratives we've used to fill those gaps break down, when we realize that we don't actually know the people we thought we know as well as we thought we did, or that people don't actually know us as well as we would like them to, that we can't really communicate the whole of the experience we're having in a way that someone else is going to perceive exactly the way we perceive it. Those breakdowns were a thing I really am interested in as a writer, and that I think a lot of the stories get into.
Well, and in this particular case, right, it's about whether or not this author whose work really resonated with this woman, it could be really difficult to tell in the past who was queer and closeted.
Yes.
Frankly speaking, like, there aren't that many Gertrudes and Alices around who can just, like, who seemed like out of the womb they were just the perfect lesbian couple who, like,
right.
it's like that you could go to for wisdom, even though they didn't talk about it much. They just lived open in Paris, and it's like, okay, yeah, but if you lived in the United States, up until, I don't know, there are still people closeted now in the United States.
Absolutely.
Because they don't feel safe, or that they worry, perhaps correctly, that their social standing and their social relationships and their family relationships will just become much more complicated at best, depending on the people involved. So, yeah, the ambiguity. Okay, like, is this writer a lesbian? Was this writer a lesbian? Because I'm getting all of these vibes, and she's inspired me, even though the stories aren't explicitly about that, although there's one story that ambiguously could be about that. And partly it's role models. Like, okay, if she could do that, I could do that. Oh, but if that didn't mean what I thought it meant, then what does it mean that I think I can do that? And
Right. Exactly. I mean, like, you know, as a queer person myself, that story drew really heavily from my own experiences. Of course, the author described in that story, Anais Casey, is not a real person, but there were a lot of shades of experiences I did have with real authors I loved, whose work I felt I saw myself in. And then, as you said, when you try to go back to look for any evidence that a person might be queer, usually the best you're going to find is deeply inconclusive. And often, in the case of the author in this, the fictional author in this story, and some of the authors I looked into, you will find statements they made that were overtly homophobic. And those open up questions sort of is this a statement this person meant? Is it a statement this person made to protect themselves in a time where being associated with queerness would have been really dangerous for them? Is it both? Like, were they both a queer person and someone who had internalized this disgust that society held toward their identity? And I think that especially when those sort of connections to history are so sparse, because as you said, those are a kind of role model and they're proof that you can succeed in the field you want to succeed in, writing about the kind of thing you want to write about. But even more than that, they're proof that people like you have always existed. Like, I think when we talk about especially queerness, because that's this identity that if you are forced to, can often be camouflaged for a certain period of time, whereas other sort of marginalized identities that we think of might be more visible and harder to closet. I think you see this real deficit of examples of us in history and sort of examples you can cite to go, no, this isn't a trend. This isn't some 21st century whatever. This is a part of the human condition that has existed as long as art and literature and our species have. And so there's something that feels almost protective about being able to cite those examples, legitimizing. And so I think you can, when you do find one that really speaks to you, you can get defensive of and attached to it in a way that is disproportionate to how you might feel about other sort of historical authors whose work you just like, because there's more to it than that.
Well, I think of so many, I don't know, interesting examples like Virginia Woolf, who clearly seemed bisexual, although not having access to that much of her interior life, like, you know, like, okay, so how gay was she actually? Like, it seems mind-boggling to say, no, she wasn't gay, like, based on all the information we have, but the scant information we have about her female lover or lovers also doesn't give us room to make a lot of conclusions. And it's like, Virginia Woolf's work is so strange and critiques gender construction and so many things. You know, she's such an amazing writer, and it's almost like David Bowie, like, okay, he's everything to all people because of just how strange and evocative the work is. But it would be great to have a simple answer to some things, like
it really would. And I think that's something we often see with these sort of figures who are, I mean, Virginia Woolf, less so, because there is certainly documentation of her intense relationships with other women, if not in extensive documentation necessarily of the nature of all of those relationships. But when we have figures where we're connecting them to queerness based more on the nature of their work than on any details we have of their personal life, often the only thing we can know is that this person felt in some way alienated from, or as if they didn't belong within, the context they lived in. And that is something I think speaks deeply to a lot of queer people, because that's a very essential part of being queer in a society that isn't super accepting of that. But of course, there are other ways to feel that kind of alienation. It doesn't necessarily come down to queerness. And so you have this ambiguity of probably it really seems like it, but maybe it was something else.
Because the question of, okay, like, was Virginia Woolf queer? Like, almost certainly.
Right.
But what does it mean? It's like, okay, I have, like, okay, I can't even begin to formulate an answer. Like, what does it mean?
Right.
Other and than, you know, I mean, she was fairly buttoned down about her private life anyway, so it's it's not like she's going to write a tell-all going, oh, the woman I've slept with, like that, like, that's just not who she is. Like, Joyce might put that in a novel, but it's not information we're going to have, I think, from Virginia Woolf. I think also of Joan Jett, who is a lesbian, and, well, I mean, for a lot of her career, it wouldn't have been, say, for marketable for her to just be out, but also, no, she's a heavy metal chick, so, like, or a hard rock chick, so her wearing leather and stuff, no, that wasn't her being butch, that was her being rock and roll, I think. She hasn't spoken a lot about this, but I think she didn't want her rock and rollness to be conflated with her sexual identity.
Right.
That's just my guess. But
yeah.
But she's like such a recent figure. She's still making music. She's still touring. And like, what does her queerness mean? Like, I don't know.
Right. And I mean, I think that's part of the way that this conversation is still ongoing with present day figures, present day writers and artists. And because even though we currently and in some places live in a world where it is relatively safe to speak openly about your identity, though God knows in the United States right now, there are some efforts to walk that back. But I think despite that, being queer, being a queer artist is still going to have a very defining mark on your career. It's still going to be a big part of how people understand your work and how it's contextualized and how the things you do in your work are contextualized. And we see that in sort of the own voices movement in publishing, where there's this, I think, really well-intentioned pressure to get more people telling stories about their own experiences, but that, especially with queer authors, can result in this mandate to out yourself if you want to tell stories about your own life. I think that we get to this point where there's a sort of tension of interests between it is good for the queer community and for queer people at large to have more authors and artists and public figures who are out and who are speaking openly about their identity and talking about their experiences of queerness. But that sort of broadly true point, I think, can sometimes equate to an assumption that queer authors, queer artists owe us some level of openness about their identity, like owe us coming out of the closet because it's good for the queer community as a whole. And I think it's a lot more complicated than that. Like, this is still a deeply personal choice. And even in trying to uplift more people telling their own stories or telling stories that have to do with their own identities, I do think we need to leave space for people who don't want that part of their life to be public for whatever reason, because it would put them in danger or because it would define their work in a way they would rather not have it defined.
Or they don't have a language to describe exactly what their experience and understanding is. I mean, like, I'm pretty sure I'm like 99% straight. But if straight people are really excited about me being straight, it's like, okay, I'm going to lean into that 1% just because I feel like I don't want to belong to that club. Like, I don't mind if that's a demographic category, but if people start turning it into something special, like, no, it's not special. Like, it's all right, you know, but, and I just imagine there are queer people who are like, all right, so they're figuring out exactly which part of the Venn diagram I'm in, but people aren't even looking at the Venn diagram. They just want a label. And it's like, I totally understand. Like, I'm not going to walk in and put the label around me like a blanket and then wear it because other people want me to wear it. I totally get the contrarian spirit of, I don't think I've figured out exactly which category works. And also, I think of so many queer people who their categories change as they evolve or understand or become more comfortable with, you know, who they are and what they're about. Mm-hmm. And I know that if I evolve, I would rather just say something when it's done rather than have to account for myself at these different stages. And, you know, being like a middle-aged white dude, like seldom do people go, explain who you are, like explain your categories. But if they did, I could just, I could so easily just being sick of it going, fuck you. No, I don't. Just
absolutely. Yeah.
Read my work if you want. If not, that's fine too. But yeah, just stop bothering me about these adjectives. I don't.
Yeah, I think we need to extend to queer people and to other marginalized groups the same sort of right we extend to people who have these identities that are assumed to be default. But you also have a right to just say, it's none of your business. It's my life and it's none of your business.
And while I like this conversation very much, I also don't want to give the suggestion that this is like a primer for queer theory or anything.
No.
Your book, like, queerness comes up, I think, and, you know, in the spirit of ambiguity, I feel like there are different ways that it's treated, and none of them are proselytizing to your readers who, it's a literary collection of short stories from Norton, so it's probably not a lot of neocons picking this up going, I can't wait to read this. But, you know, the emphasis is on the storytelling, and so I think the ambiguity around gender, especially in adolescence, for me, added a lot of the pleasure of the book. And so I want to make sure listeners don't think, okay, and it's homework because you have to learn how to, like, no.
Yeah, no, I like I am a queer person. I draw a lot from my personal experiences. So thinking about queerness and gender and sexuality is certainly a theme that runs through the book, but it's, I would not say it is a book about being queer. It's a book by a queer person, but that's all.
Dear listeners, this is your friend, Chris Booth. If you have enjoyed this program, which comes to you absolutely free, and are wondering what you might do to support this show, please, please, please write a review of the podcast on iTunes, comment on the website, and most of all, tell your friends. If you buy books online, please click on the Powell's link on the left-hand side of the website. Doing so will grant this show a small commission on anything you purchase, at no expense at all to you, and help support both a wonderful podcast and a wonderful brick-and-mortar independent bookstore in Portland, Oregon. If you must use the services of the metastasizing mega-corporate empire Amazon.com, then there is a similar link to Amazon further down the page on the left-hand side. You fiends. Thank you for listening. I will now resume drinking. Ever yours, Christopher.
So, take only what belongs to you, maybe one of my favorite stories about a library. I think not enough stories are set in libraries.
I agree. For reasons sort of similar to the ones in the story, I had wanted to go to the Library of Congress for a while. And so I had done a lot of research into it and was excited to use it as a setting.
And, you know, dealing with literary legacy, which is tricky to make interesting in a short story. Okay, so this is about a different writer who is studying another writer. And it's like, okay, like we're... the framing is kind of interesting here. And... she's got a girlfriend who might be the perfect partner for tolerating this or understanding it, but it's hard to tell which is it. Is she tolerating this or is she understanding it? It seems like she's tolerating it more than understanding it. But on the other hand, her willingness to understand just, okay, why are you so obsessed with this?
Right.
Her willingness to understand, her desire to understand counts for a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's sort of the major tension in that part of the story, kind of the act of love that is seeing someone you really care about being really, really interested in something and really, really emotionally invested in it and just not really getting it, but deciding that because they care about it so much, because it means so much to them, you are going to at the least try to be a cheerleader for that. And the sort of tension on the other side of that of being grateful that that person wants to see you enjoy this thing, wants to support your interest in it, but also wanting to be seen a little bit more than that, wishing that you could make somebody understand why this thing is so important to you. Like, I think it's a tension of two people who are doing their best, but aren't quite giving each other what they need.
Let's talk about Algil Bloom. The story that opens it about two teenagers spending a summer together or part of a summer together near a lake that has toxic algae growing in it, and they're told not to go in it. So, of course, the whole story is about their compulsion to go into the water.
Right.
While paying close attention to their families, who at least one of the families is starting to look pretty weird.
Yeah.
Which is something that happens when people go on vacation. It's like, oh, fuck, this is what my family is actually like. Oh,
yeah.
I hadn't noticed that before. All right. when can I start drinking? 3 o'clock? We're on vacation, right?
And it's extra hard when you're 13 and you're not allowed to start drinking for about 8 years.
Yeah. Or at least not drinking enough. Yeah. To me, that really felt like teen behavior. Especially when you feel like you're really close to someone and you're not sure what that means, and you can almost take it for granted, except you're terrified it's going to go away.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that, I mean, that's sort of the major kind of ambiguity in that story, or one of them, at least. These two teenage or sort of pre-teenage girls who have this really intense relationship that is a friendship, but also a little bit more than that, has these sort of overtones of something else that they're not really willing to put a name to, because putting a name to it would change what it is, but also not willing to let go of or ignore. And I wanted to get at that particular kind of relationship that I think can only really exist when you're of an age where you don't know how to describe those things yet. Because even if you're not naming it between you and the other person, as soon as you sort of know how to recognize these things as sexual or romantic or even possibly that, then that changes the context of it. But when you're young, and I think this is maybe something that happens especially for queer people, just because we're sort of not looking for that desire where it shows up, but I think probably happens to everyone to some extent around that like pre-adolescent time, where you're experiencing these feelings that are kind of terrifyingly intense, and you can't really name yet what makes this friendship different from all your other friendships.
And, you know, depending on who you are and when you are, like the language of queerness, it, like if that doesn't exist, I don't know, the imaginative work it takes to begin to think about these things. It's like, or I could just leave it in an unfinished state and I get to enjoy a lot of spending time with this lovely person who I'm awfully excited about. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I make both of us declare ourselves gay, among other things, the decision tree includes decisions that can't be made by you.
Right.
And it could make the whole summer ugly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, even just that, like, that early feeling of having a crush, whether it's queer or not, where you're sort of realizing like, oh, as soon as this is a crush, then the whole rules of engagement change, especially when you're young. Like you have to deal with a crush so differently than you get to deal with a friendship. And so it's almost like by acknowledging the intensity of your feelings for someone, you have to create distance between yourself and them. And so it's this thing where if you really think about how deeply you feel for someone, then that feeling is going to change with this kind of observer effect.
Because it would be unethical to just be intimate with someone you're crushing on and they don't know?
I think so. And also I think just because, you know, when we're like adolescents, especially, we have these ideas of how romance or sex are supposed to go. Like we have scripts that I think we don't apply as heavily for friendship. Like, I don't think we kind of have the same rules around how we engage with our friends. And then once we're engaging with someone who we're thinking about them in that way, even if they don't know it, even if it's not something we plan to talk about, it just changes how we frame that context.
So instead, you could focus on healthier things like swimming in toxic algae.
Exactly. Yeah.
Although that also seemed like Anthony Burgess, in describing the characters of A Clockwork Orange, who referred to the prerogatives of youth, which is just a deliciously evil phrase to describe teen behaviors, where it's like, well, all right, that's a horrible, wrong thing to do. Let's do it.
Right. I'm going to do this just because of how stupid I can feel it is.
And until you have something go pretty bad or watch something go pretty bad for someone else. Mm-hmm. You know, you're still a child testing.
Right. And I think there's this draw to push boundaries and sort of to see how far you can go, especially I think if you've been privileged enough, safe enough to live a kind of life where you haven't really seen something go terribly for someone yet. It feels very safe to go, oh, well, even if the adults are saying this could go bad, it's not like it could go that bad.
When in fact, it can go exactly that bad.
It can go very bad, yes. Often worse than you're being told.
Yeah, it was 5 or 6 years ago now right, at Walt Disney World. I live in Orlando. So on the other side of town, there was a family from Nebraska, and the dad, tired, is watching a movie on a beach at the hotel right next to a child's water play area with a lifeguard. And instead, he let his child play in the lake, which, by the way, has brain-eating amoeba in it, so you shouldn't be in there. There was also a sign saying, no swimming, don't feed the animals. And the kid is just there splashing, and it's like that's like a dinner bell for a gator. And so the child was taken away by a gator, and it's like, I think the argument I'm making is Walt Disney World can infantilize perfectly grown people who think, how bad could it be? It's Disney. It's like, well, it's a swamp.
Right.
And like, when gators get too big, they normally get them out of there. And that gator was like almost 5 feet. Just big enough to grab a very small child who was in water where the child should not have been.
Oh, man. Yeah. I mean, I think the mechanism that maybe lets that happen in an adult's brain at Disney World is the mechanism that lets that happen in a teenager's brain all the time, because it's this sort of feeling of, oh, well, there's someone else taking care of it. Like, there's a grown up, there's an authority figure who has a general kind of hand on the danger around you, and there'd be something else to stop you before it got really real. But there isn't, often, because the authority figure is, you know, your parent or Disneyland, and they're not necessarily doing as great a job as you imagine they are.
Yeah, I was on a ride at Walt Disney World, a log flume ride, and you know, me and my idiot friends, we were in our 20s, by the way. So old adolescents, I guess you might call us, but we're like, let's see if we could rock the boat. Like, how much do you think we could rock the boat? And we're just like, okay, everyone lean this way, lean that way, lean this way, lean that. And then water starts slurping over the side. And I'm like, oh, we could do some real damage to the boat and ourselves. Like, we could maybe die if we really commit to this plan. I'm like, all right, let's not do this. No more of that. I think for teenagers, when they're told not to, like, that's a trigger for them. Like, all right, so we're doing it. When are we doing it? But we're definitely doing it.
Right. Yeah. It's being invited to test the boundaries of it.
And speaking of testing the boundaries, you've got a story called The Changeling.
Yes. Yeah, that's my favorite one about children making bad decisions.
So there are distant family members, or not that distant, but not part of the nuclear family, but
yeah, cousins.
There's a woman who is giving birth after she thought she couldn't, and she has an adopted child who is friends with the main character of the story. And it's so vivid, because I remember being a child and adults good-naturedly try and give you information. And often the information is incomplete. And then, like, you start working with this body of information you have,
right,
and end up coming to strange conclusions that the people giving you the information would never have given you the information if they thought it would lead to this, like the conversation would go differently.
Right.
And I think it has a lot to do with just how, again, how difficult it is to understand other people and parents doing their best job to simplify the world for kids so that the kids can understand how the world works. And in some ways, it's just more fuel for confusion.
Yeah. What I was really interested in that story is this kind of magical thinking that is inherent to children, like this, that, like, there's very clearly a kind of logic at work when you see a kid come to a conclusion, but it's also very clearly sort of a different kind of logic than what we're working with as adults, and how children take that imperfect information, like you said, and apply the worldview they've managed to assemble to it and sort of work toward what to them feels like a very logical conclusion, because it's logical based on the evidence that they have and the really strange things that can come of that. Because I was a child that did that a lot. Like, my parents were very big believers in give your kid all of the information and let them work it out. And My favorite example of this is when I was around 6 or 7, my father explained to me what mad cow disease was, because there was an outbreak of it. And he explained in some detail, and I never ate beef again. I went vegetarian around age 12, so it was only about a 6-year gap. But for 6 years, I just didn't eat beef, because I was like, well, this can happen to some cows. That must mean it can happen to every cow, and I will never, ever have this meat again. And so that sort of logic, you know, when it's turned inward, often results in these really irrational anxieties or patterns of behavior. But when kids turn it outward, or especially when they collaborate on it with each other, it can become something that's really exciting and interesting, but also occasionally a little bit dangerous. It can motivate kids to make decisions they might not have if they'd have had sort of an adult to go, wait, there's some information missing in the conclusion you've just drawn. But it's also kind of antithetical to the way that kids work at that age to involve an adult in that logical process. And so just kind of exploring how wrong that could go was what I was interested in that story.
And some adults aren't smart.
Right.
Or don't, yeah, like it doesn't occur to them how weird it could get.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I took the GRE back when dinosaurs roamed the earth sometime in the 90s. And I remember I took the general test and then I took the specialized literature test.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lunch break. So I went to McDonald's because that was the only place available near the testing site.
Right.
And I'm there watching a dad, and I can't verify this, but had to be a divorced dad with his son. And the son is like trying to play with his car that he got in the Happy Meal, and he's not eating, and the dad's like, you have to eat, and he's like, vroom, and he's like, I'm taking the car away, and the kid's just like staring at the dad, and he goes, you have to eat. He goes, eat the cheeseburger, it came from a perfectly good cow. And the little boy's like, a moo cow? And the dad's like, yeah. And then the tears burst, and it was, I have to admit, one of the happiest experiences of my whole life, just watching this. And it's like, I felt bad for the child, but it's like
a very low stakes car wreck in slow motion.
Yeah. Like, oh, and remind him this comes from cows now. That's going to motivate him to eat.
Yeah, that's going to help.
Some sort of Catholic guilt about, yeah, like the cow's already dead. It's a sin if we don't eat it. Like, I don't.
Good logic for a child.
I think it also points out I'm at least partly a bad person, because you go to the theater often. What you're going to watch is not as entertaining as that exchange.
Yeah, I think there's some kind of satisfaction to watching people make mistakes that we can kind of watch happen in real time and that aren't going to have any very serious consequences, but you just sort of go, oh, you should have known that was going to happen.
So Fruiting Bodies, the title story of this collection, magic realism, big time, a woman discovers that the growth in her body isn't cancer, but in fact, mushrooms, which leads to a very insular relationship with her girlfriend. And they live kind of off the grid, and they end up getting a mysterious stranger staying with them when he injures his foot and there are no navigable roads. And so an annoying stranger who injures his foot has no simple, ready means of getting out of their house.
Right.
And so this couple, each woman has a different attitude towards how much you should help strangers.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, it was so much fun. I mean, I realize that this is a couple in crisis and this is putting a real strain on their relationship. And also the fellow's just so perfectly annoying.
Thank you. Yeah, that one was actually one of the ones I had the most fun writing, in part, I think, because it is a lot of fun to just really dig into an obnoxious character and to kind of really get to have your narrator just really hate someone and express that throughout the narration. You know, I think there's a kind of fun to doing that as an author that I definitely wouldn't want to pursue in all of my stories, but it was a nice change of pace from what I often do. I also, that story was fun for me to write because it was the only story in the collection that I really set out to write as horror. And I've had mixed reviews on whether it actually achieved being a horror story, but I was really interested in a lot of those tropes of sort of isolation, power, kind of how we interact with things that feel other, this element of body horror and strangeness, and kind of flipping some of those horror tropes on their heads a little bit in having the protagonists be the people who have this kind of strange and monstrous thing happening to their bodies and take almost a pride in it, or like find this kind of intimacy in it, and having their, the sort of invading force in this horror story, be this very normal, average guy. I had a lot of fun with that.
Yeah, it didn't feel like a horror story to me. Definitely felt some comedy. And I think, you know, it's quite literary, because Arthur is both terrible and not.
Mm-hmm.
And he's nice enough to where you think, oh, just let bad things happen to him. Fuck that guy. Like, he's just nice enough and thoughtful enough for it to be complicated, you know, for right. him not to simply be, I don't know, like in horror movies, there's the character who clearly has to die first. He's usually the one mm-hmm. going, guys, where are you?
Right.
Like, and there's nothing but annoyance, you know,
right.
in experiencing that character. Whereas poor Arthur, it's funny a lot of the time, where it's just like, all right, we've come up with a solution. Oh, that won't work because of this. And it's like,
right.
When will he get out of my house?
Yeah, which that was another thing I enjoyed in that story, just sort of replicating the feeling of, you know, having to be around a person for whatever reason who you really don't like very much, but, you know, taken to particularly intense extremes. And yeah, that was a balance I really wanted to strike with Arthur, where he's frustrating enough that, I mean, the narrator has this really deep loathing for him that often goes sort of beyond what seems reasonable for the actual actions he's taking. And so I wanted to make him frustrating enough that that loathing feels like sympathetic and understandable, and you can get where that frustration is coming from, but also sympathetic enough that it doesn't necessarily feel like that frustration or the actions the characters take because of it, I'm not going to go into any further details, are necessarily deserved. Like, it doesn't feel like he has actually done something to get the sort of a comeuppance he gets.
I think it might work as a play.
Oh, that's a high compliment.
It would require special effects, but apart from that problem, right? I mean, this is a cabin in the woods kind of a story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did sort of feel a little play-like in writing it, just because it is like such an enclosed space. Like, there's a set, you have these three characters, and there's a lot of, another thing I found really enjoyable about writing it is how much of it kind of occurs in the moment and in the action. Like, there's a lot of focus on the little interactions between the characters and the tension in those interactions that I think sets that story apart from the rest of the collection, where a lot of the stories have a wider scope or have more time with characters kind of introspecting.
Yeah, no, the dialogue is brilliant.
Thank you.
So can you talk a little bit about getting the book to Norton and what that process was like, and what edits maybe happened?
Yeah. So this book was, I think my novel is going to have to be really, really difficult, because I got off too easy with how this book came together. I wrote a lot of these stories during my MFA. I got my MFA at UW-Madison. So a lot of the stories came together over the course of that. And I had a really great advisor in that program who kind of helped me shape them into the beginnings of what became this book. And then I did some editing independently for a few months. I had met Meredith, who would become my agent, in my first year of the program, actually, when she had kind of come to visit and speak to us. And we'd had a really great conversation then about Hunting the Viper King, which was one of the stories that ended up in the collection, an early draft of it. And in talking, you know, I only had a short story, so obviously there wasn't any conversation of representation then, but she did indicate that when I had something more complete, I should send it along to her. And I had really enjoyed our meeting. So she was the first person I got in touch with and the person who wound up taking the book. And then she put together a list. We found Norton. It really, everything came together very smoothly in terms of finding an editor who liked the book, negotiating the terms of the contract, all of that. I am a very anxious person and was prepared to just be in pieces for a couple of years while we played this out. And so it was really wonderful that it just kind of worked. And then once the actual editing process, you know, with the editor came into play, most of the stories by then had been through several rounds of editing because I'd been submitting them to like magazines and individual publications. I think the ones that got the most rewriting were Is This You and Fiddler Fool Pair. They both, for whatever reason, just the drafts weren't doing what they needed to be doing. And so I went through, I think, 4 or 5 rewrites of each of those. Fiddler, I was about ready to throw out by the time I actually got the revision done that ended up going into the book. I think that is the story I've been most frustrated with, but I think it turned out all right. So yeah, it was all pretty straightforward in this case.
Yeah, that is something that fills me with anxiety, is the prospect of revising and editing a story so much that I can't really sense what's happening in anymore.
Right.
Like, okay, like it doesn't feel solid. And so it's like, I don't know what needs to be changed at a certain point.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very frustrating to get to that point. By the time I was on my last couple of edits, I was, you know, tapping in my friends, like, I need you to read this and tell me if it still makes any sense at all, because I've gotten to the point where all of this is Greek to me.
I suspect that's why when I write short stories, I try and keep them really short.
Mm-hmm.
3,000-4,000 words. So I'm not approaching New Yorker length stories ever.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that might also say something about my ability to concentrate. Yeah, I just try not to create so many words and so many scenes that could require me having to think about them that much. For some reason, I think if I'm going to do that work, it's like, I just write the novel.
Fair. Yeah. I, for whatever reason, writing, you know, very compact stories is just a skill I've never had. I've certainly tried. And I can say, I don't know that your focus is the problem, because I'm terribly distractible and I tend to write, my average first drafts tend to be around 10 to 12,000 words. And then hopefully they get edited down to a slightly more publishable length.
But that's old school. That's like the length that short stories used to be.
It's the length that works for me, at least. I've come to accept it's the length I'm going to be writing at, because every time I sit down to write a 2,000-word short story, I end up with an 8,000-word one.
So it's not a hipster affectation, it's just the way you work.
Yeah, I have tried very hard to do other things. It doesn't happen.
Well, that's the show for this week. I would like to thank Catherine Harlan and our sponsor, Scribophile. If you like this podcast, please do share the news on social media or use Passenger Pigeon if you're more comfortable that way, and leave a review wherever it is that you stream podcasts. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including Perfect Advice from Dr. Perfect, Comic Book Reviews by Drew Barth, and Reviews of Schlock by Jeff Schuster. All right, gang, until next week, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and God damn it, don't swallow the worm.
Dear listeners, writers, and fellow Odysseans, send your questions, observations, complaints, manifestos, transcriptions of Turkish opera, and whatever else you got to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
A while back, John King endowed the Museum of Schlock and tasked me, Jeff Schuster, with curating the bugger. Each week I curate one more entry into this proud genre of film. I think. Truth is, I'm really not sure what schlock is, but my writing about it is sublime. Read it every Friday at thedrunkenodyssey.com.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.